Hi, from Issaquah, Washington, this is Deepak Singh.
And from Cambridge, Massachusetts, this is Hari Jairam.
And you're listening to The Coast
to Coast
Bio
Podcast.
Hey Hari, how are you?
Hello, Atom. It's been a while. Yeah, I'm very fine, very fine.
I'm glad we don't call this a weekly.
I know, exactly. Well, the only thing weekly I was going through was, I don't know, I had this fever or something that knocked me out for like a week. So yeah. I finally recovered. So that's part of the reason why we weren't recording last week and so on.
Yeah, and I've been on the road and traveling and busy, so it's just been crazy. Actually, last week, I think I had company over here, and you were busy and you had just fallen sick, so we couldn't record. But yeah, better late than never. I think you had a busy weekend also catching up with some of our old friends in Rhode Island.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, it was a blast. It lasted too short, actually. It was just 24 hours. But all in all, yeah, it was funny. Like, I got out of bed and went and partied. That's pretty much what I did.
Yeah, and we shall not talk about the details on this podcast because it would probably impact the ratings. As in, we are a PG podcast.
Severely.
Knowing those folks, that's not going to hold water around here. Yeah. So anyway, we have a bunch of things to talk about. So, given the fact that we're starting a little late today, why don't we just jump into it, unless you had anything specific you wanted to talk about before we got going.
Yeah, let's jump into it, you know. We had was the last episode our longest one?
I believe it was over an hour.
Yeah, okay. So let's jump into it, this one, hoping to make this almost, but not longer.
We'll see. I think it might just be a little shorter, but we say that every time, don't we?
Yep.
So our first couple of stories are both related to synthetic biology. And I started wanting to talk about a blog post that I wrote, but it's about a company called Codon Devices, which is based in your neck of the woods. I think it's in Cambridge or somewhere in Boston.
Connecticut, I think. Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah, it might be in Connecticut too. I mean, the only reason I figured it was Boston was that Keith Robison used to work at Codon Devices, and he used to be at Millennium. So I just assumed it was in the same town as Millennium. Anyway, Codon shut its doors, and part of the reason I think it shut its doors, of course, the economy sucks right now, so it's just difficult to get additional funding. People are tight on experimental projects and so on. But I think from what I understood, Codon's business model was to create material for other companies in the synthetic biology space, basically companies in the bioenergy or other spaces. And if those companies aren't doing well or there's not enough of them, it sort of makes it difficult for Codon to function. So I think it can have a trickle-down effect, and why it was one of the first companies to shut its doors. You know, I'm not particularly fond of the term synthetic biology, but obviously the people who worked at Codon were smart people. And, you know, I've been reading Keith's blog for a very long time, and he's a very serious scientist. So it's kind of sucks that, you know, that company had to shut down. But I just wanted to hear, you know, what you had to say about synthetic biology as a commercial enterprise.
So, yeah, you're right. Codon Devices, it seems, is headquartered in Cambridge, MA. So they must be local, probably right around the corner from here. I don't think this has anything to say about synthetic biology as much as it has to say about the economy, I think. Of course, you know, a lot of synthetic biology is, it's very early in the game. And I don't know, I guess there's Amyris, which is Jake Heasling's company. There's, you know, Codon Devices. There's Craig Venter's. A bunch of them are doing it. And I think I think the promise of synthetic biology definitely still holds. And I just think this is just bad timing for something like, you know, Codon Devices. And I don't think it has anything to do with the long-term future of synthetic biology or any of that stuff. And I think I I'm starting to become like a bigger and bigger fan of the promise of synthetic biology, only because of the fact that, there is definitely a lot to be said about having, bacteria do important things for you. It's kind of old-fashioned biotech, really. One of the things we started with in biotech was let's engineer bacteria to do everything, and it's not like we even went down that road. I mean, I think we have real problems to tackle, and I think synthetic biology will actually start tackling them, Actually, just 2 days back, we were talking to the people from QIAGEN, actually, and they are launching this new venture, which is a collaboration with, let's see, GeneArt. There you go. So GeneArt's a German company. Anyway, it's not really synthetic biology, but they are optimizing genes for expression in bacteria and other systems, actually mostly bacteria, using algorithms which have been developed over the last many years. The algorithms, it seems, are proprietary, but in the end you get a synthetic gene, and they just launched this thing where you can get a synthetic gene for any gene in the human genome. So, all anyway, but what I'm saying is I think it's these are very early days, and I really think this is more about the economy than it is about synthetic biology. And I've seen small lab scale experiments on like making butane and so on as well, and I think that's where even in labs synthetic biology is still early. So I think for a company it's even earlier. So I just think it's bad timing. So that's my take at least.
Yeah, and I don't disagree with you. I think the challenge, and you, I think, hit the nail on the head, is one of the things that I think about, and it's a challenge that any company needs to face, is if you have some interesting lab technology, when do you commercialize?
Right.
And if you time it wrong, you're going to be in trouble. It's not so bad these days, but I remember in the late 1990s, early 2000s, everything was getting commercialized. And there was a whole bunch of things that had no business becoming companies. It was just some PI had some cool technology. The university tech transfer offices were like, oh, we've got the dot biotech boom going on. Let's try and cash in on it.
Right.
And you ended up, we used, when we were at Geneformatics, our CEO used to use this term bio debris for as companies were going under, as did we, I guess, in the end.
Right.
I think synthetic biology, it's there's not a synthetic biology in every corner, company in every corner. So it's not like that's being abused, but it's a challenge that any academic tech transfer facility has to face, is when do you commercialize academic lab technology? When is it ready? And I guess in Codon's case, the economy kind of made sure that it wasn't ready, even though the technology might actually have been quite mature. I'm not familiar enough with it, but judging from who was there, I would suspect it was good technology. I think the advantage that some of, say, companies like Amyris and the stuff that Craig Venter do is, A, they're very, very well funded because of who started, who started them.
Deeper
And
pockets.
deeper pockets. And I think the technology is also, especially in Kiesling's case, have been around for a while. He's been working on them for a long time.
Right.
And so
Exactly.
it's, yeah, so it's not like the technology needs to be tested. It's a scale-up manufacturing process that needs to be figured out. And how do you go from lab scale to commercial grade scale, which is what VCs take the risk for in the end, right?
Right.
So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see if, once the economy stabilizes, if there'll be a return, especially given the energy policies of the new government. Even though, biofuels are much maligned in some areas, but this is not the biofuels that are getting maligned. This is not, this is not corn-based biofuels. These are organism-based biofuels and organism-based improvements in fuel production and other areas. So it'll be very, and I'm fascinated. I know people like Nitin Baliga here in town, who do a lot of computational work on trying to engineer bacteria and trying to see what circuits can be used to
Right.
build, bacteria which have various properties. So, and that's really fascinating. I know it scares the crap out of some people when you start talking about synthetic bacteria, but still.
Cool. Yeah. Speaking of scaring the crap out of people, maybe we can segue to our next story, which is along the same lines, right? It's the fact that the iGEM, the International Competition on the Genetically Engineered Machines, This is Drew Endy's gig, right? Coming out of
Correct.
MIT.
Yeah,
But
although he's in Stanford now, I think, isn't it? But I
is
think,
he? Oh,
yeah,
really?
he moved to Stanford.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay. So
I think so.
the iGEM announced recently that it's closing the doors. So basically, the iGEM is something like a bio Olympiad of sorts, where it was inviting teams of people to participate in interesting tasks, which was, kind of along the lines of using the bio bricks and so on to building, circuits, biological circuits, and to getting them to do interesting things. And it was kind of like the poster child for the, well, I guess the early synthetic biology movement, like taking it to younger grad scale biologists all over, well, the world actually. It was an international competition. But they recently announced that they are closing their doors and not accepting, non affiliated participants. So you have to come from a school or an institution and be able to carry out the work under a supervised framework in order to participate. And this was a pretty, I think it's a pretty big change because the main platform that the iGEM was kind of campaigning on was that biology is now at the point that you can do it in your garage, So you do not need to be in a university, I mean, sorry, or a college or a school or something like that. But garage biology or DIY biology was their platform. And then I guess, it's kind of a recognition of the fact that, A, this is not that, I guess, easy to do. And I think they were giving in to the concerns raised by everybody that how can you have, people in a garage engineering biological organisms? It just doesn't sound right. But anyway, it doesn't seem like it's that big a step backwards. But in terms of what they are saying as their main thing they have to offer to biology, it is definitely a step backward in the sense that now you have to be a formal, a school or something like that to participate. So what do you think, Adam? Is this like a good thing, bad thing, or is it just
It's
inconsequential?
I have two opinions on it. I think that in the last 20 years, the whole do-it-yourself science, garage science tradition that us chemists used to have, like garage chemistry is always like everything is always fun, right? I mean, burning up magnesium ribbons and stuff like that. I mean, in my opinion, every kid should do that. There's this book called How Toons. That is by I'm forgetting the gentleman's name. He's Tim
Tim
O'Reilly's
O'Reilly's
Tim O'Reilly
son-in-law.
son-in-law.
That's how I know him too. Poor guy.
I've actually seen him talk about How Toons at SIFU, so I should know his name. But he won a MacArthur Award also, so I'm just his name just escapes me. It's basically about two kids doing garage chemistry for all practical, using stuff at home, among other things. Biology is a slightly different beast because the risks are beyond. I mean, in chemistry, the risk is you blow up the house. In biology, the risks are a little more. So I understand the concern that, and I know why iGEM did it. It was just one reason, in my opinion, liability. The organizers of the university or somebody must have told the iGEM people, we just can't take the liability of something going wrong for non-experts doing this. Then maybe the insurance associated with it would just go up. Some lawyer somewhere must have looked at it and said, can't do it. And I understand the concern. The thing I haven't figured out, and I'm no biologist, I don't know how to do a biological experiment to save my skin, except if it's inside a computer, is where do you draw the line in between garage biology and the kind to so that kids get interested in doing things biology at home and getting into doing PCR and stuff like that, for example. I know people give the whole bioterrorism excuse. That's a load of you know what. I think the real concerns are things can just go out of hand and you suddenly have this virus running amok or something like that because somebody made a stupid mistake. And it's possible. I mean, it's not trivial. It's not that it's not easy for it to happen, but things can go wrong. You might get an infection. You might get some mold or
Exactly.
something
True.
spreading. So, as somebody who gets his hands dirty, you, not
All the
me,
time.
you know, where do you think you draw the line in this?
you
'Cause
know, I, I
I
just
understand,
think like I think it's a I do not think even to this day, however easy you make biology, it's that trivial that you can do it in a garage. I mean, yeah, you might be able to get a PCR reaction to work, you know, with like using 4 cups of water at different temperatures or something. But it's still fairly a difficult, you know, experimentation in biology is very involved. It's a little more involved than, you know, elementary experimentation in chemistry. And I just think that it's laudable that, you know, DIY bio and all are trying to make it, you know, demystifying it to allow everybody to think of doing it, but it still is not that easy that you can, you know, engineer it the way they say you can, where you mix A plus B and you always get C. You know, it's that's rarely true in biology. I mean, you
Biology
know,
is just not as clean as chemistry.
even to
Chemistry,
this day, like I work in a lab using, you know, a kit that's made by a company, and I don't get it to work the exact same way every time. I mean, and my hands aren't really like clumsy or, you know, they're not, you know, if I can make a mistake, so can somebody in a lab. And, you know, all said and done, we do have rules about, you know, how you if you have a recombinant bug, you know, you can't really flush it down the sink and so on and so forth. There's some rules you have to practice. And those rules do make sense. I mean, you know, some of them are paranoid, but all said and done, if you have something that can replicate, the onus is on you to not flush it down the toilet, you know, for example. So, yeah, I think these are real concerns. I think it's good that these guys demystify this to make it more approachable, to make kids want to tinker with biology. That's a very good thing. But all said and done, it is not that trivial that, you know, you say that everybody can do it in their garage. I mean, trivializing it probably is not. Is a is taking things a little too far. I think
Yeah,
it would,
so
so what this is a good development actually. Now you have schools and you know, yeah, sure. You know, if you're a school kid, yeah, you there's very little damage you can do really. I mean, it's only good can come out of tinkering with biology when you're a school kid.
and I
But
think that's the I think that's I think you just answered the question that I was asking about that dividing line. I actually think with the iGEM competition, if you're doing it under certain closed environments in a lab that's approved, that has appropriate safety measures in place with approved supervision, I don't see why amateurs cannot do it. I think we need to
Exactly.
make sure we can generate environments where it's possible.
Right.
I do completely agree that garage level biology, where you're doing real genetic manipulations, is likely always going to remain illegal,
Right.
or
And I
most.
have no strong feelings. You know, I think that's fine. You know, it's okay. If every school was able to like engineer bacteria, I'd rather have that than every garage, you know, also be allowed to do it. I don't care. You know, it's like most stuff in my lab is done by undergrads even now. You know, like we have undergrads who come in, you know, they're like a few years out of high school, but there's no reason why, you know, a 10-year-old cannot, you know, handle bacteria and make recombinant bugs. But that I that's okay, but I don't want, you know, everybody to do it in the garages. That's a little far-fetched, I think.
And I think the challenge here is and I if you look go back to and I think the important thing here is for organizations to allow kids to do this not as part of school curricula but for fun, but generating the environments that allows people to learn.
And that's
I
one
remember
thing these BioBricks guys have really done a very good job with, you know, making these pieces available, you know, having plasmids and having, you know, vectors and having simple tools. Like, I think it's very powerful to, you know, be able to make bacteria that smell fine or, you know, things like that are very, very cool experiments that the BioBricks people have worked very hard at making it possible to do easily. And that's great. And that's why I think the iGEM is a great thing. But, you know, I think when the sales pitch should stop at schools, you know, taking it to like, oh yeah, you should be able to do this in your kitchen is a little ridiculous, I think.
I mean, I remember one of the best fun projects when I was in undergrad in India. In the summers, I used to do lab work. I used to, in the university, there used to be these lab projects which you could, apply for a project and do it. And these were pretty interesting projects. I remember the fun of the ones that I did was doing spectroscopy on enzyme action. So looking at some phenol-based action where you connected everything. You know, you had this old PC with two floppy disks which you connected to a spectrometer and measured time. You know, the impact of pH on an enzyme action. You know, this was not done as part of a course. It wasn't done for credit. It was something I did in the holidays in a lab, supervised. And I think if you could generate that for students, even like high school kids today in the biology world, that's the direction we should go in. I agree with you. I don't think the law will ever allow garage biology to be done. The risks are just too high today. And I don't think that's going to change. It's just the nature of the beast. Nobody's allowing you to build nuclear weapons inside nuclear. You don't do nuclear testing in your garage either. And it's not for the security and terrorism thing. It's just there's a risk involved to persons and so on. Which is
Actually, yeah, while we are on this, if you haven't heard that a debate between Drew Endy and the Greenpeace guy, again, I forget his name.
I think we talked about it in one of the
It is earlier
earlier
episodes. Definitely go check it out because I absolutely agree with all the detractors of, you know, garage biology. And that's a very nice debate. I think both of them state their cases very well. Cool.
And talking of bioengineering and synthetic biology and all that, there was a story in Seed about an article about work done in David Baker's lab where they engineered a protein to have some enzyme action. It's kind of an interesting one because it got posted on Hacker News, and you know, non-scientists were like, "Oh my God, this is amazing!" And I agree, this is great. I mean, being able to engineer a purely engineered from scratch using computational methods to start with a certain kind of with certain catalytic activity, nothing close to a real enzyme, but the fact that you could do it is great. I think my challenge with my beef with this was the way the scientific press tends to mix, you know, things sound better than they are. But it's really cool science, right? I think we aren't too far away. I mean, when I say too far away, I mean 25 years, when we'll be able to actually design proteins that have real enzyme level performance, catalytic. Right now, we are still a fraction. But with the combination of computational design and synthetic biology, sort of those two working together, I think we'll start getting there, and you know, understanding how proteins fold, and then,
Hey,
or at
actually,
least,
Adam, I had a question for you. I thought this was really cool, and David Baker is actually on my, you know, if I were to coin a list of my top, you know, labs which I just idolize and think they're awesome, David Baker is definitely on that list. And there was, I think, that field, right, the designer protein field, had recently a few setbacks, right? Wasn't there one of their poster childs was exposed for fraud? He had like two science
Oh yeah,
papers in a name.
this is the guy Homi Hellinga, the
Hellinger,
protein.
there you go. Yeah, that's right. I mean, so hell, and I think, you know, after that, a lot of people were like, ah, yeah, you know, I told you so. This stuff just doesn't work, and it's just too hard to do, or whatever, right? I mean, there were a lot of detractors, and so Hellinger also had a bunch of these designer enzymes, right? Which were looking at catalyzing funky reactions and making designer mutations in known enzymes. I think Hellinger did it with a known enzyme, but David Baker's is really amazing because you know these are designer proteins. No, I think it's a cool area, and I know, yeah, it's the popular
It's my
press's
favorite. It was
job,
it was
right?
my it was my it's my favorite area in science to some extent. Oh,
Right.
I think I like looking at real systems and understanding them. I think because of my years in the nanobiology world, where there was so much
Hype.
unnecessary hype
Yeah.
associated with this, I still get very irritated when people overhype it. David Baker's lab is, I think, the best computational structural biology lab on the
Absolutely,
planet.
right. Yeah.
I mean, nothing comes close, in
Yeah,
my
he
opinion. The work they've done over the last decade is incredible.
Actually, yeah.
And but I you know, the way I stand at it is, we have a long way to go. Let's
Right.
not make it sound like this is going to happen
Yeah.
right
Well,
around the
that's the
corner.
popular press's, you know, job to screw things up. So there you go.
Yeah, one would expect seed to do a better job.
Oh,
You know,
right, exactly.
but
Yeah, that is true.
yeah,
But
but yeah, I mean, I definitely, I mean, I haven't met David Baikal. My wife has,
Actually, I
so
met
I'm
him.
kind of
We had
jealous.
hosted him as grad students.
Yeah.
Him, like some of these guys, like David Baker, Bill DeGrado,
Yeah.
then Stephen Mayo. I think those are all
Yeah.
like my fan list of chemists turned awesome protein design engineering people. Really
Yeah,
cool
and
stuff.
yeah, and I'm spending a lot of time in the protein structure prediction world, as you know, in the early as the at the turn of the century, when all these guys were coming up and getting well known, was very interesting. You know, the Homi Alinga thing is actually kind of close to home, because I know people who know him really well, and
Really,
I've
huh?
actually I know him very well personally.
Yeah.
They were in the same lab and worked together and things like that,
Wow.
so as postdocs. So yeah, so I was very, you know, I've read all his papers,
Yeah,
and
so they
especially when
had
I
what? They've retracted their four big papers, right? Which talked of engineering these activities into enzymes, and some of his own ex-lab mates came out strongly against him, saying that, he wasn't really looking into the controls and the other aspects of the experiments, and so that really was a quite a setback to the design of protein field. So
Yeah, it's good. I mean, I've seen the great thing about the Baker stuff is that they're making steady progress.
right, yeah.
They did something a couple of years ago. This is even better. So it'll be interesting to see where the algorithms go. I still feel we haven't understood the physics of protein structure well enough to really solve the problem.
Right, yeah.
A lot of the heuristic-based methods that we are using today only go so far to really take that step, because none of this exists in a vacuum. For a protein to function, that it is part of a whole system, and we are so far away from getting there. It's great science, but in terms of application, it's still I keep cautioning people. We need to understand protein complexes and proteins in the natural environment, and that's the dirty beauty of biology. It's not clean systems. It's not an optimal system. It's got solve. You know, you're in a buffer with all kinds of crap around you,
And I think that's
and
exactly, it's funny, this kind of ties into synthetic biology as well, right? We've been trying to engineer, a bacteria to make, what, lactic acid or something better for 20 years, and we're just about getting there. To expect us to suddenly start making biofuels that can power like all the cars in California or something in even a few years, I don't know. I don't think it's going to be that easy,
Yeah. What will be interesting is if we can start making designer molecules that can work in a controlled environment,
Right, exactly.
where you can build a synthetic system, not a real system, a synthetic system where you can optimize the conditions. I think even that's really hard, because we don't understand how those conditions work today. I mean, because we don't really know how proteins fold, you know, really.
That's why I still have a job. Well, anyway.
Yeah, we figure all of this out. At some point in time, you know, 20, 30 years from now, then we can have controlled synthetic environments, a synthetic cell, a synthetic something, where we can start doing a lot of these things computationally and then actually doing them. I think that's going to happen sooner, way sooner than actually doing it in native environments. That's my guess, but it'll be interesting. We got, you know, I think we'll get there. And, you know, this is just one step in the process. Sort of moving away from designer bugs, and maybe we should just call that. The show should be called Designer Bugs. Blowing up designer bugs in a lab, in a garage at home. I wanted to talk about something somewhat close to home, because it comes from the online biogeek community. For people who are part of what I would call the bio gang on places like FriendFeed, is something called Reflect, which won the Elsevier Grand Challenge. Which we've talked about before, I think. We talked about the Elsevier Grand Challenge
Correct,
in an
yeah.
earlier episode, especially around Roderick Page's work, if I remember correctly.
So he didn't make it, huh, to the top.
I think he made it to the final, but he didn't win.
Oh, okay.
But Reflect comes from a bunch of people. The two that I know online are Lars Juel Jensen and Michael Kuhn, who were both at EMBL at the time. I think Lars is now in Denmark. He has a faculty position there. It's a really neat little tool that does something that I really like. The way it works is you either feed in a URL, or there's a Firefox and an Internet Explorer plugin, And if you're on a page where there's an molecular entity, either a protein or a compound that it recognizes, it highlights it, and then you can mouse over on that to get more information about that entity. And then there's additional links inside it which can take you to a PDB sum page, stitch page, and so on. And obviously, this was done for a competition, so this is not the final version by any chance, by any standards. But even in its current version, it's very neat, and it's just the kind of entity extraction, simple entity extraction engine that I really like. I know Rod Page has already talked about adding taxonomy and things like that to it. You know, there's stuff like Zemanta and OpenCalais in the general publishing world, which I use it on my blog, where they can recognize names, companies, things like that, and automatically extract that information. It's really good to see. I mean, I think they're a well-deserving winner. So just for details, they provide domain substructure, subcellular localization, 3D structure, and interaction partners for each protein and gene. For small molecules, Reflect provides the chemical structure and interaction partners. That's pretty neat. So I just wanted to
bring that up. Yeah, I was checking it out. It's nice. I haven't really looked at more of... So these are what? Just overlays on web pages, right? So they...
Yeah, so you go to any Wikipedia page, you know, type in P38 kinase into Google, go to the Wikipedia page that comes up. I think they're using there's a dictionary that underneath that powers this. So apparently they have an 18 gigabyte dictionary that they keep in RAM.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
So it's a Firefox plugin, right? That's what it is.
Yeah, it's either a Firefox plugin or you can enter the URL on the go to the Reflect webpage. It's reflect.ws.
Right.
Go to that page and enter the. They have a box there. You enter the URL, so it takes you. It opens up that. Yeah.
So it'll mark up and display it internally with all the add-ins. This is neat. So I've actually, speaking of Reflect, I've started playing around with Ubiquiti, right? Which you told me about first. And I think the future really is in, JavaScript on top of... I think JavaScript is it's really going to become even bigger now. And things like this really make me, I've always had one of my goals on Codeitch was to learn JavaScript, and I just, makes me want to jump right in because this is super cool stuff to be able to, enrich a page on the fly, and it's neat stuff. Yeah, thanks, Atom. This is really nice. And no, but I was telling you, right, Ubiquiti, the thing is really cool. There's very few biological applications and functions right now available for it, but I'm sure I hope actually it really catches on, and I've started trying to write something that'll automatically look at the PDB and PDB sum, for example, using it's just simple XML based stuff that you write. And it's neat. I can't wait for Pierre or someone like that to start programming Ubiquiti plugins.
Rajarshi has been doing stuff on the chemistry side.
Oh yeah, for Ubiquiti.
He has a bunch of endpoints that he keeps. Which
oh wow, cool.
You type in the smile string, it gives a structure. Or you type in a compound name, and it gives you a smile string. Typical Rajarshi, right?
Very quick. No, it's neat stuff. I'm started playing around with Ubiquiti. So, it's once I get off this current busy streak, I definitely want to get into JavaScript more.
Yeah, I mean, my challenge is just trying to figure out what I want to do first. There's so many things to do. Yeah, so these days I'm just sticking to Rails stuff, but I'll come back to JavaScript later.
Right.
Once I figure this stuff out, it'll take a while, given my speed. Yeah, no, it was very neat to see somebody from our sort of community online win
and, the grand challenge, right?
And the fact that it was really useful and really cool.
Yeah.
So I'm actually writing a blog post, and I did a quick screencast about how it works also, which I'll be putting up on my blog very shortly. Very crude screencast. I actually need to get ISHOU or ScreenFlow working. I just ended up using Jing, which is good, but
that's what nowadays
it's
I
very,
use
it's,
Jing actually a lot. So
you use Jing a lot?
Yeah, because
yeah,
it's quick and it's so
I find it
easy.
Very limiting because I can't edit it afterwards.
That's
and
true,
do stuff.
But
yeah.
Anyway, you know, it's like
yeah, the function about adjusting the size and things like that.
Right.
Yeah, it's very difficult because obviously I wanted to keep a larger screen, but I had to adjust it. I think that's why ScreenFlow is really great because you just record full screen.
Right.
And you do everything else later.
Correct, yeah.
Yeah. So it works really well. I actually heard that the next, in Snow Leopard, QuickTime is going to have screen capture built into it.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. I didn't hear that, but that sounds really cool if they do.
Yeah, it's a new rumor.
You
so
know,
apparently,
I can't wait for... We said that when we started Bias Screencast, right? I think in another year, of course, it's been now 3 years now. We said screen capture... And, you know, direct transcode or into whatever, into online YouTube Flash will become like a everyday feature in every OS. And that's when screencasting as a communication medium will really take off. And if that's true, at least with Snow Leopard, I'm sure, you know, I hope it's going to really become easy for people to quickly capture and then push to web. You know, that'll be neat.
Yeah, I think the functionality it'll have will be equivalent to like Snap Z Pro.
Right.
Something like that. Yeah. So that'll be really neat. Because what I've also heard is that QuickTime Pro will be native to Snow Leopard, not QuickTime.
Yeah, that's true. They're going to remove the, make all of it free. I mean, not free, as in part of the OS. So you don't
It'll be like iLife essentially.
Right.
Where it's native. If you want to upgrade, you probably might have to pay, you know.
Yeah.
But if you're upgrading operating systems, you get it with the next version with it.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. So something like that. Yeah, because Matt Wood and Alexander Griegspoor have been trying to get me to get iWork because they both believe Keynote is the best thing since sliced bread. And then some.
I recently bought iWork, actually. I gave my talk at the Biophysical Society on Keynote. And a couple of people came up to me after that and said, hey, good to see Keynote being represented. I was like, how could you tell? They're like, what? What do you mean, how could you tell? I was like, no, I mean, you know, I thought it's a presentation. It was, they're like, wow, it's like every slide is so much slicker looking. I said, oh, okay, good. Well, I haven't used PowerPoint in like 4 years, so I didn't really realize that Keynote's that much better, you know. But it is very intuitive to use, and I like it.
Yeah,
I like it a lot.
Yeah, I use PowerPoint on the Mac. And
actually, speaking of, I might be meeting Alex Griegspoor. Well, at least not meeting him, but I signed up for the SB Grid, which is like this consortium in Boston, has a workshop in a week's time, actually, in Boston.
And he's there, right?
He's coming down. So I signed up mostly because I want to talk to some of the crystallographers who are showing up and having workshops. And I was like, hey, I'm going to be there at that workshop anyway. So I signed up for programming in Coco session with Alex Griegspoor.
You're doing a Coco thing. Yeah, I mean,
exactly.
Alex and Matt are supposed to let us know what they're doing next week. So I'm actually eagerly looking forward to that. Because they've been dropping hints that they let the world know what's going on.
Right. So this is a papers update or something, probably, right? Along those lines.
Pardon?
If you were to speculate. Matt's at Macintosh, right, now? I mean,
yeah, Matt's officially and publicly in Macintosh now.
I see. Cool. Awesome.
Yeah. The other thing that is interesting is Matt's organizing this thing called Active Research at RailsConf. So basically the idea is to set up, it's named after Active Record, which is the Rails ORM. So it's a community that they've set up. He set up at RailsConf it starts off as a birds of a feather type of session for science in Rails. So there's Arfon from the Galaxy Zoo project and there's somebody else giving a talk. But I think the long-term goal is to make this into sort of a scientific Rails community. So it'll be interesting to see how that grows. But yeah, you should definitely meet Alexander because it's always good to meet people we know online. Every time I meet somebody new, and I met Pedro and Shirley for the first time recently. So it was kind of cool seeing them and actually I knew what they looked like, but actually physically meeting them was kind of
awesome.
Nice. Yeah. So those were, I think, the formal stories that we had on our list today, if I remember correctly. Is there anything else specifically that you wanted to talk about now that we are 40 minutes into our podcast?
No, actually, we can go on to our geek sub segment on, where we talk about general geek stories that caught your eye. And hey, actually, I have been listening to, I continue listening to Vincent Racaniello's and Dick DePaulmier's TWIV, This Week in Virology podcast, and it's awesome, actually. They've been covering this whole, apparently there's like a SARS outbreak, well, at least one case of SARS reported, and then the whole porcine flu thing. It's really cool. It's a great podcast, actually. So, anyway, but I thought I'll give them a mid-podcast plug.
No, they're
They have
it's
sponsors now too, actually. They
yeah.
have
Well, I think they hit it big when they got mentioned in Net at Night, I believe. Amber MacArthur brought them on as her podcast of the week, which is really cool. I think Leo Laporte is a big
TWIV
fan
listener
of,
now,
well, not just of TWIV, of hyper niche podcasting. Instead of focusing on a general topic, find a niche and cater to that. And I think that was part of the reason why I was very excited about Coast to Coast Bio, was that, and to keep us to our bio geek roots, like stick to the really geeky part of biology and not try and make this a general biology or bioscience podcast. Because, that's our shtick, as I like to say. The nerd biology. And talking of nerd biology, I'll let you take this because Pierre Lindenbaum, I think, is just
Oh,
one of
the
the
Hadoop
he,
thing?
yeah,
Hey,
he's just
that's all
amazing.
you, Atom. You're the MapReduce Hadoop guy. So, yeah, it seems like I guess Pierre's been learning the ropes of Apache Hadoop, and they are, basically the implementation of the MapReduce algorithm. And other than for that, yeah, I didn't really dig into the post much, but could
Yeah, I
you?
mean, I think it's not about digging in. So basically, the thing that always amazes me about Pierre is somebody will start talking about something, and 3 days later, he has a blog post with code on his blog.
Yeah, exactly. He's
He's just amazing.
the quickest from like new technology to hello world to rudimentary app person I've ever seen, and it's inspirational, actually.
I get suitably green around the gills when I see that. But the thing that I really got a kick out of was the last line on his pod. Basically goes through a bunch of screenshots on how to do it and how HDFS works and how he played with it and how things worked. But my favorite part of the entire blog post was this really cool line. If I can find it, it'll be quick. Here we go. It's just forget the clusters. I'm running this Hadoop engine on my one and only laptop. So it's a one node Hadoop cluster, and which is kind of funny because the way HDFS works, it actually creates three copies of everything, which is why it's really hard sometimes to make a smaller Hadoop cluster, because when you take nodes off, it has to rebuild HDFS and create three new copies, as opposed, yeah. So, or to make it bigger. So resizing Hadoop clusters can be a challenge. And, but hats off to Pierre. I mean, it's just amazing. And for those of you who want to learn Hadoop and figure out how it works, take a look at his blog post. And if I can make a very shameless plug for my day job, we have a service called Elastic MapReduce now on Amazon, which actually allows you to forget about how you set up a cluster and just write MapReduce code in a Hadoop framework. So it's a good place to deploy Hadoop code if you can figure out how to write it. So, for example, Pierre wrote it up on his laptop. So, and if he has a working algorithm and he doesn't have access to a cluster because he has one laptop and he wants to run something, it's a great place to just drop in the code and run it.
The
And that's
Elastic
kind of,
MapReduce from AWS.
So I won't say anything more because I try not, I don't want to,
That's
I don't
okay.
like
I'm
my,
asking you, so there you
Yeah, but
go.
it's exactly it is meant for this kind of use case
Cool.
where you only have a laptop and you want to try things out. Yeah, so that was geek item number one. I believe you had one as well, or was
Oh,
yeah, you had a
Jaunty
bu
Jackalope.
Oh, I actually installed it this morning.
Oh, did you? Oh, so you're more qualified to talk about it than I am. No,
I haven't done anything with it.
I'm waiting to finish this paper to actually install it. But yeah, so the newest release of the Ubuntu platform is out, and it seems to have the buzz was all about it having ext4 support finally in, which I guess is kind of neat. I was trying to look up what's great about ext4, but I couldn't. Nothing seemed overly awesome about ext4, but yeah, it seems like it's as always, these guys keep giving us new and nice Linux installations. I'm running Ubuntu on just about every machine now. That's my become my Linux distro of choice, but I'm still at Hardy Heron, I think. I haven't moved beyond that.
Yeah, I was at Hardy Heron too, and I upgraded. So I run it on a virtual machine on my Mac, and I upgraded to. I'm still on Hardy on my slice.
I see.
But on my Mac now, as of this morning, I have Jaunty Jackalope. I haven't done anything with it. I'm actually very excited about Karmic Koala because it's got EC2 APIs built into it. But I
Is that the
actually I don't know.
next one?
Yeah, that's the next one, right?
Karmic Koala?
Go.
Oh my goodness. All right. Actually, I'm glad because it was so easy to find stories about the Ubuntu release because you just have to see Jaunty Jackalope and you get exactly what you want because neither of those words, I'm sure, yet occur together. And something tells me Karmic Koala will be like that too. Oh yeah, actually, speaking of koalas, they were talking about koalas on the Twiv podcast about how they are reservoirs for a bunch of interesting retroviruses and chlamydia. So there you go. Your karmic chlamydial koala.
I think that's the name of our podcast, Your Karmic Chlamydial Koala. Let's see how that goes with people. Yeah, so I shall write it down. Yeah, hang on. Keep talking. You had some sub version control stuff that you wanted to
Oh
talk
yeah,
about.
actually, yeah. So the other geek thing was I recently started looking at Mercurial because the NetBeans Python people started, I mean, use Mercurial for their distributed version control system. But the whole DVCS movement is mainstream enough now that Python adopted Mercurial. And now Google Code announced that they're actually offering, along with Subversion, which is their main version control system, they have now announced that they are supporting Mercurial hosting as well. So
Yeah,
if you have a
and
Mercurial
yeah.
project, you should be able to get right and start using Google Code as the repository. And I think they are also announcing, well, via Git SVN, right? Support for Git.
Yeah, they announced that a while ago that they would support Git SVN
Right.
because it's pretty clear to me now that there's going to be a bunch of code. SourceForge just is gone. Just go to that page and it looks like a place for spam because there's ads and crap like everywhere.
Right.
GitHub has and Google Code are where I think everybody will put their projects
Right.
by and
Exactly.
large.
Yeah.
And your Git projects will go to GitHub, your Mercurial projects will go to Google Code, your Git SVN projects will probably go to Google Code as well, SVN, Git SVN projects. And it's pretty nice to see. I mean, distributed version control is now definitely mainstream.
Correct, exactly. And it's cool. Well, I'm actually looking for a quick tutorial on Mercurial. So if anybody knows one, send it in as a link
Yeah,
and
you need the screencasting community. I mean, I think one of the nice things of the Git Rails community, they're really
Right.
into screencasting.
Yeah,
So
exactly. Yeah.
everything becomes a screencast.
Right. I mean, it's not that different, I guess, because Mercurial was kind of
But it's
based off
easier.
of
Yeah, it's easier,
yeah,
right?
off of Git, but still, yeah, it's nice to know of a quick screencast, and I haven't found one yet. But that was neat. I thought, I definitely want to start using Mercurial as well. And this will be kind of cool to check out because a lot of the crystallography code projects are hosted off Google Code, actually. So that's neat. And I don't know Subversion to save my life. I've never used it. I mean, I've used it other than to check out stuff, but that's about it.
I think what who I think it's also the distributed version control community sort of standardizing around two distributions, Git and Mercurial. It leaves out Bazaar, I think, gets left out, which
So
will make
Chris
Crystallization.
is not too happy about that. I saw some back and forths between him and some of the Python head honchos saying, "Why not Bazaar?" And well, anyway, I don't know what's different, but
Me neither. So I won't. I know Git's not everybody's cup of tea, but I really like it.
Yeah, I use it all the time too.
I'm actually planning to keep sticking to this geek thing. There's a company called Heroku, which went commercial. They've been around for a while, but they launched a commercial product this week, and they have a free layer for initial development stuff. So I'm going to try using it. One of the nice things I like about Heroku, apart from the fact that they're running on Amazon, as is EngineYard, which is a competitor in a way of theirs. So these are basically Google App Engine for Rails applications, or basically anything that's Rack-based will run using Ruby Rack. But the way you deploy code to Heroku is using Git push. You basically take your repo into a Git push, and you have your app running on their platform, which I think is really neat. The some of the features of these distributed version control systems will come into good use as code deployment, it looks like it. Just sort of sticking to the same lines. The other geek thing I had this week was launch of Ensemble Genomes. Ensemble Genomes comes from Ensemble, duh. And basically, they have non-vertebrate genomes as part of the Ensemble search now, which is, I guess, something that hadn't wasn't didn't exist yet, and it's kind of neat to see that there. So it went live on 20th April. So you have three sites: bacteria.ensemble.org, protists for protists.ensemble.com, and metazoa.ensemble.com. These will provide access to DNA and protein sequences, positional and functional annotation of protein coding and non-protein coding genes, repeat analysis, and other features. So, apparently, one of the new features that they've added is the inclusion of a multi-way comparative genomic analysis using
Whoa.
a selection of species from bacteria to humans.
Cool.
And so you can create nice gene trees to infer ancestral relationships between
Nice.
sort of conserved protein families, which is, I think, very neat. That's pretty much all I had. So, and
All right, so I guess it's time for our links of the week.
Why don't you lead?
Okay, I guess so. My link of the week is basically, it's a very long blog post, but it's blogoff.francescomugnai.com, and it's a list of 25. Actually, maybe if you Google for 25 great free resources for making charts. So it's basically a summary of all the free libraries out there, mostly JavaScript libraries for charting on the web. And it's a very good list of all the libraries and how they kind of stack up in doing some basic charts. Some of the examples covered in francescomugnai.com's post is, JS charts. I didn't know about this. It's a JavaScript-based chart generator. Then, of course, the Google charting API is on there. There's ProtoViz, which is a visualization tool script for JavaScript. There's some of these which are Silverlight-based, but still, it doesn't include JavaScripting live support. And
Does it
then
include
there's
processing, the processing JavaScript library?
he doesn't talk about processing, and let me see. It's not. There's 25 mentioned. There's JFree chart, which actually your wife allowed me to tinker with sometime back. And this is J free chart for Flash. That's kind of cool. There's Flare. There's the I don't see processing yet. There's
So
time
I think
plot.
this, how old is this blog post?
Oh, there's Plotkit. Hold on. How old is this? 2009, 425. So it's recent.
So it should,
Yeah,
because
2 days old. There you go. Yeah, okay.
processing.js is pretty new, but it's
Oh,
not a
yeah, I
no.
know. Yeah, that's the whole processing implemented in JavaScript instead of actually the jQuery guy, right? John Resig's
Yeah,
behind
John
it.
Resig did it. It's a
Right,
beautiful
exactly. Yeah.
website, and since we are on the on the topic of JavaScript libraries for charting and graphing, I think processing.js should also, people should take a look at that as well.
Yeah, I haven't looked at that, but yeah, that's supposed to be really cool, actually, the fact that they implemented the entire processing Java stack on JavaScript. And in fact, along with my JavaScript whole thing is my next big thing I want to get into is is processing an Arduino. That's my
And definitely, as a crystallographer and the kind of work that you do processing, I think it'll have a lot of value for some of the things you have in mind. Excellent. So go ahead.
Yeah, anyway, so yeah, it's a very huge list, and it's a very, very nice to see all the examples in one place and check it out. And I don't see processing UIs on here, you know.
UI.
But yeah, YUI and Flare, and yeah, I've started reading up on this whole open, you know, how JavaScript is open, and it's just about going to do everything, almost everything Flash does. So it's really kind of the,
well, I'm a big fan for powerful JavaScript, you know, kind of sort of going to the Sprout Core side of things, powerful JavaScript implementation of features that you do in Flash now, just because Flash is so non-web native.
Right.
In many ways. No, maybe that's Flash will win out in the end, and there's certain things. I mean,
I don't know.
Like
I don't think so. I think because of like things like Chrome and everybody's getting behind. I mean,
I agree.
Not that Flash and ActionScript is that different, but of course they do have a lot more traction. But I think sooner or later, it's the other guys with all their open implementations will start to really make a dent, I guess.
Yeah, I think what you'll end up doing, having a sort of 3-4 approaches to doing things. You'll do native things like native H.264, which in some cases is the best solution for video. I think embedded video and things like that will remain Flash.
Flash,
it works really well there.
Right.
But I think for a lot of rich features on websites, that with Chrome and the next, you know, sort of the upgrades to the Firefox JavaScript engine.
Correct.
And things like that, the V8 engine or whatever they call it.
Yeah.
And, you know, developing things like Sprout Core and Cappuccino. And, you know, Cappuccino is amazing. I mean, just looking at that website, whatever it's called, the one that came out of the Keynote people, the one that looks like Keynote, 280 slides, which is all JavaScript. It's not Flash. It's amazing. I think it gives you a sense of where people are going to go. Anyway, sort of moving on from that, my link of the week is sticking to the distributed version control world is develop.github.com. It's the GitHub developer site. It's resources on using the official GitHub API. It's a really neat website. It contains documentation on the major API sections and libraries. So you can actually use GitHub as part of your coding now. So it has, you have an API to your repository. You have an API to your commits. You have an API to their issue tracking service. You have an API to their user service network, you know, because it's a social network around code. You have APIs to the network graph and an object API, which gets full versions of specific trees and files in your Git repositories that rely on GitHub, especially if you're using that as your core core sort of master repo. It's a open source website, so their tagline is, this website is open source, please help us by forking the project and adding to it. So, which is one reason I like the GitHub folks so much. So that's
awesome.
That's again one of our very niche, specific to one community links of the week, but there you go.
Awesome, cool. How long are we? Did we beat our last week's record, or?
I did not think we beat a lot.
No,
we
are 58 right now. So
yeah, we are about 8 minutes short, but let's not try and
beat it. Yeah, let's not try and beat it.
Alrighty. Having said that, just the usual, you can download our podcast on iTunes. You can visit our friend feed room for Coast to Coast Bio. And you can, you can add and comment on items there. We are streaming our delicious feed into that. Our delicious feed is at c2cdelicious.com/c2cbio. You can send us subjects that you might want us to talk about by tagging them /c2cbio.
Or you could even write in on our friend feed room. I both of us monitor that continuously.
And it's all obviously so many of our listeners are probably on friend feed, and we thank you for listening. It we've been getting lots of downloads, so we like that. So that's about it. Mishakwa Deepak signing off.
And this is Hari signing off from Cambridge. Bye.
Bye-bye.